Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Welcome to Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and this episode is brought to you by patrons David, Dempsey Tapley, and Evelyn Belasco. Today we have Sarah Adina Smith on. She's a director that's directed some awesome movies and a bunch of TV shows that hopefully you've heard of. FX's Legion. She directed HBO's Room 104. She just did the pilot for Hannah for Amazon Prime in Romania. I mean, pretty sick freaking resume.
Pretty awesome resume. But her roots are deep, deep in the indie world. She started making a micro-budget feature that launched into a moderately budgeted feature and then segued into television. So she is the indie dream come true in many ways. She had a long road to get there. She had a lot of struggles that she'll talk about with us on the show. And now also the finer points of enjoying a TV career finally.
Yeah, I think both of our favorite parts is just how many times she failed and how many times she got rejected by film festivals and kept going, which hopefully is like a little bit of what the heart of this podcast is, which is it's not easy for anyone, but everyone that's very hardworking seems to get somewhere.
Yeah, and she got there. And since we had such an awesome conversation with Sarah Adina Smith, we decided to forego our catch-up once again, but we'll get back to it soon. But before we get to our conversation with her, Oren, tell me about our Patreon page.
Yeah, our Patreon page is patreon.com/justshootitpod. It is a place where if you listen to this podcast, let's say you've listened to every episode, half the episodes, 10 episodes, and you feel like you're getting something out of it, it's helping convince you to move to Hollywood and try to become a big film director, or you just like to make fun of us or our weird speech patterns, then check it out because you can help us make this podcast and keep going forever. On Patreon, you can give some money to us, $1 a month, $2 a month, whatever you want, and we will use that money to pay our editors, put on live events like the live event that we just broadcast recently, and it just really helps us keep going. So check it out, patreon.com/justshootitpod.
Great, Oren. Let's hop into our conversation with Sarah Adina Smith.
Okay. We are here with Sarah Adina Smith.
Hello, Sarah.
Hi, guys.
Is it true that you demand everyone call you by all three names?
All the time. Yep.
ATN.
Even my parents, even my family.
Really?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
I do have like name anxiety. I don't like being a three-name person.
Yeah, Sarah Smith is
I didn't want to be a three-name person. Yeah, I didn't want to be a three-name person.
How'd you end up being a TN?
Because I'm named Sarah Smith, and like it's real tough to develop a name for yourself.
To brand yourself.
Yeah.
Do you come from a family of blacksmiths?
Yes, actually, in Russia.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Straight up Jewish blacksmiths who like somehow got the name
yeah.
Smith.
I mean, there's a lot of Jews in the anvil business.
Yeah.
I actually have
a lot of pride about coming from blacksmiths because it feels in some ways as if it was like related to some ancient magic or alchemy. Mm-hmm. That's what I like to think.
Yeah, I mean, you are like bending metal with a hammer,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, this is based on like...
It's more impressive if you do it with your mind. Like
yeah.
Uri Geller, do you guys know who he is? Mm. Famous Israeli mentalist. I've been like obsessed with mentalists recently. Do you know who Lior Suchard is?
No.
Oh, he's going to be my unpaid endorsement. Just wait. Anyway, Sarah, you're a director.
I am.
Sarah, walk us through the lightning round of all of your awesome credits real quick.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Okay, I'll do it. Midnight Swim was your debut feature.
Yeah. Sorry.
And then you were part of an anthology called...
Holidays,
and then Buster's Mouth Heart.
And I'm not related to Kevin Smith. People ask me that sometimes.
Well, I was going to tell you to tell him hi and how proud I am of him, but that's fine.
I wish I could. Never met him.
Midnight Swim, Holidays, which was an anthology, and then Buster's Mouth Heart. Mm-hmm. And then you made the leap into television, and you did...
Room 104, and then a show called Wrecked. And then a show called Legion, and I just finished directing a couple of episodes of a new show for Amazon called Hannah.
Right. So the
you only do one word named shows.
You only do one word named shows. Oh, so Room 104, Room HBO. 104. Way to have a nice
one word and a number.
Nice little debut there on TV.
And yeah, then, I just slid right into HBO. Yeah. I was like, I'm going to do TV. Yeah.
I'm gonna do
what I'm going to do is
just the best stuff. And
premium.
Then Wrecked. That's the
It's a TBS.
TBS show.
That's
yeah.
like Ginger Comedy. Gonzaga and Crashing Guy.
George Basil?
Oh, George
yes,
Basil.
George
He's
Basil.
A good friend. I literally just saw him last night. We had dinner with George Basil. He has a short film he's finishing now that I helped edit for
him. Awesome.
Oh, cool. And he lives around here. I see him.
Exactly.
Very funny
George
man.
George Basil's like family.
And then Amazon Prime. So you just get to do all the good stuff, basically. Oh, so, FX. I forgot. Legion is on FX.
Yeah.
So, cool. You should check out like AMC maybe.
Yeah. That'd Have you heard cool. of the E Network? Yeah. They're doing some scripted stuff now.
Are they?
Yeah.
Wrecked is a comedy.
Wrecked is a comedy.
Do you not think of yourself as funny?
I don't know why they hired me for that job all the way. I mean, I like to laugh.
Yeah.
Enjoy laughter.
Often, Mike, you were funny as well.
Thank
you are
you.
Quippy,
I'm
I would
quippy.
Say. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm a comedy director per se. I think I had a really great time doing those episodes, and I feel proud of those episodes. But I don't know. That's not where my passion lies per se. Mm-hmm. I like dark comedy and like sort of twisted, absurdist comedy a lot. But I don't know that I'm like as much into maybe broad or sort of comedy with a capital C.
Sure,
comedy.
That makes sense.
Oh, I thought it was a K.
see what I'm up against?
But do you think that you approach directing comedy totally different than like a Legion?
In the case of Wrecked or Legion, I'm a kind of as a director, you're a guest artist on someone else's show. And so you're really wanting to do service to the showrunner's vision on those shows. So with Wrecked, it was really important to get a bunch of coverage and a bunch of funny options to have in the edit room, which is very different than like how Noah Hawley approaches Legion, which is really like let the camera tell the story, try lots of weird and crazy and fun things cinematically, which may mean that you don't do any coverage in the scene because you're going to try something so ambitious that really like you either get it or you don't, which is great.
What a wild spread to do them. Yeah. Yeah, but like I think I live more in the world of like I've shot a hell of a lot of cross coverage with two cameras and like throwing alts at people. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean?
Which is good fun.
Sure.
It's really fun.
Yeah, yeah. And it is a different sort of filmmaking. And so I think that I found a lot of comfort in that. And I feel like, oh man, I'm so bummed that like it doesn't look more interesting as a result. And the way that you do that is you shoot a single camera and like actually move it and commit to those choices.
Totally. I tried to do as much as I could with my Wrecked episodes to give it a little bit of a sort of cinematic flavor and point of view, but also wanted to do right by the guys and make sure that I got all their funny.
Well, let's go a little bit further back. Let's start at the beginning. How did you get tell us about your first feature.
So the Midnight Swim came about through despair and failure because...
We like those stories.
Yeah. Because I had been trying to make a feature for like 7 years and kept trying to make it the way I thought you should make it, which is to raise a bunch of money and attach actors, big actors. And
and you had a script that you wrote.
Yes.
You went to film school.
Go to film school.
Oh, didn't you go to Columbia?
I went for philosophy.
Oh.
Yeah. How far back do you guys want to go?
No, I also have a non-film degree, so I like it.
Nice. So I had tried to make a couple of scripts the more traditional way, and just like kept running into walls over and over again, or I would get really close and then be super disappointed. And I had my heart really broken at some point where we thought we were much more sure we were going to go, and like the day the money was supposed to like hit the bank, it just didn't. And
so you're on set and you're like, yeah. How much?
Luckily, we weren't all the way on set, but we had like truly begun pre-production in earnest, and had hired people we needed to pay, and it was like really awful. And so,
and when you say we, you had teamed up with a producer or something?
Yeah, my two producers at the time.
And they're just friends that you found somewhere.
But they're also legitimate producers, but like,
sure. But like,
but were they like at your level, or were they like, oh, I've submitted my script to the competition and I attached these producers? Like, were they people that could make things happen that you couldn't make happen on your own?
I would say they were peers. One of whom had made a bunch of movies, and one of whom had made a couple. But we were pretty much peers. It wasn't like producers who were like, yeah, let me just call up Tom Cruise and see what he's doing. It wasn't like that kind of producer. So the money fell through, and then I like was surprised by the intensity of my depression after that time, where like I just didn't actually want to get out of bed. I've been trying so hard for so long, and just really felt like there were like doors just kept slamming in my face. So
yeah, I can only imagine. Yeah.
And I had to make the best of what was a shitty situation, which was like, we have spent some money. Like, I need to go make something. We're so far down the road with this thing. So I was like, well, maybe I'll go make another short, you know? And then luckily...
And had you made shorts at this point?
Yeah, I had made shorts.
So you just, you moved to LA, you wanted to work in film, you made some shorts, and then you had, you were trying to get this feature off the ground.
Yeah, that sounds quicker than it was.
Sure. Over the course of seven years, basically.
Yeah, and like just like spiraling amounts of debt and like other job. You know, I also like had to pay rent. So like other, I was like, I started a graphic design company and like was doing other things to try and make movies. But
I tell this story a lot, but I have these two friends that were like literally taking headshots and trying to make like YouTube videos on the side for people. And they ended up starting this company, Maker Studios.
Oh, fuck off.
Selling it for, but that, it was like, they're like, we're trying to write and direct and act in things, but no one is hiring us, so let's just do this
on
the side.
That's amazing. What a good story that is.
Your graphic design firm could have been.
Could have been that.
Did you sell your graphic design company to Disney?
Yeah, we are Pixar. Well, there you go.
Oh, it's called it, Coco, have you heard of it?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm very proud of our graphic design company, and but it was never like my dream.
It was
supporting my dream. We also like ran a green screen studio for a couple years, which was like a bad idea, because it was like we thought we would just like supplement our income in a more passively versus, you know, because it also running graphic design studio turns out like takes a lot of time, like 14 to 16 hour days. And then you have to like, you're running that business. And then you also want to make movies. That's really hard.
Yeah. And literally, you don't have to, you spend half your time
like
chasing
boss.
Down invoices.
Yeah. Oh, 1,000%.
I think a lot of our listeners are trying to, you know, have made a bunch of shorts and are trying to figure out how to get people to take them seriously enough to give them the money to either
I think that's never going to happen.
Feature,
I think
or,
I should tell them the truth.
Or to attach a name.
I think I should tell them the truth.
Yes, no, that's
is like
all
very
we
likely
seek.
Never going to happen. Which leads me to The Midnight Swim.
Love it.
Wherein I finally realized that was never going to fucking happen. There was like no magic fairy that was going to come down and get me my cast attachment or give me money. Why would they? There's no reason. I'm not like, unless you are born into a family of legacy filmmakers or born into money. There's just no one who's ever going to take that first risk on you unless you like fully take it on yourself. And for years and years, people had been telling me, mainly my husband, like, why don't we just go make a micro budget feature? Why don't we just go make a micro budget feature? And I was like, excuse me, I'm an artist. I don't know if you understand my art.
I've done the low budget stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to need, like, my art requires X, you know, and these resources. And so I felt like that was beneath me, I think, in some ways, which is such bullshit. Because
how much were you trying to raise?
For the bigger movie?
For the bigger movie, yeah.
It was 2.7 to begin with. And many of the heartache got it down to like one, between one and 1.5, something like that. Anyway, this all leads to after that money didn't come through for the like one millionth time, and I was really depressed, I was like, well, what? Finally, I was like, I should just go make another short film. And then my good friend Daniel Stam, who is an amazing filmmaker, who's Jonico Donnelly, my closest friend and creative collaborator, her husband is Daniel. Wow. Anyway, okay. We were having dinner with them, and he was like, don't you dare make a short. I was like, what? He's like, don't make another short. That's so stupid. You're wasting your time and your money. Shorts are just as hard as features. You should take whatever effort and money you were going to put into that short and just make a micro budget feature.
Wait, may I ask you what year this was?
Oh, I'm just
more than
guessing.
5 years ago.
I bet it was like 2013 or 2014, probably.
Oh, so about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
Ago. Okay.
So why, still have the economics changed drastically?
I do think the way in is like, I don't know. We get people ask us all the time if they should make a micro budget feature or like a proof of concept for like a TV show or something.
I mean, well, TV is a whole other thing, right? Yeah. I don't know. This is,
I mean, the answer is always like, just make a good micro budget feature.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think.
But if you have a short that wins Sundance because it's, you got a recognizable actor for half a day and you.
How are you going to get that actor if you haven't already made that short?
You like run into them at a party.
I guess there is certainly a way to do that, make that short. I tried to do that. I made a short called The Sirens, which I really loved and was really proud of. And I feel like I just got totally panned by festivals. Maybe it sucks. I have no perspective. Mm-hmm. I liked it a lot, but I felt really, my heart was really broken about that too. I put so much into it. And so I was like, I was thinking I'd make another play at the short route.
And just for listeners who've been rejected from every festival with their shorts, like hearing Sarah,
I almost cried just now thinking about it.
HBO and Amazon Prime shows and stuff, like, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, huge success. And like, I saw
my career.
You went back there for a second.
It's a series of rejections.
Yeah, I saw you get like a little genuinely upset though.
I'm very sensitive.
Yeah. Yeah, you're an artist. I get it. Yeah. But
artiste.
Sorry, sure.
Artisanal.
Artisanal artist. Yeah.
Not to harp on this too much. There are a hell of a lot more shorts being sent in to, say, Sundance than there are features by a magnitude of like 100, I think, quite literally.
Yeah.
And they program less shorts than features, too.
I just think also, I don't know, unless if you know a name actor personally, then you need to be writing something for that person. You need to like use whatever resources or connections that are available to you. And so then there could be, totally a short path, a path towards success through making a great short. But it's really, really hard, I think, especially if you don't have any recognizable cast in your short, to even make it to the programmer's attention. I know they say they watch everything. I just have a hard time believing that. And so, also, like, even if they do watch everything, they're going to give the benefit of the doubt to something. They're going to give their full brain to something with an actor they recognize.
I think it's true that someone watches everything.
Yeah, I believe that
there's a difference
something.
Not all programmers are ranked equally. So, like, I think you're right. Like,
it's watched by someone, not maybe someone.
But, like, watch while they're on their phone. Watch, sure, you know, like, sure. I'm just,
or,
I think,
or
like,
an intern or, like, somebody who really has to, like, put their, you know, reputation on the line to be like, hey, this is incredible versus, an agent who I trust just called me and they're, award-winning directors.
Well, something that's beyond
it's true. Not an even playing field.
Right.
People should know that.
Yeah. And we talk about this on the podcast, but having connections at a film festival makes a giant difference. It makes the difference between the person watching your film being someone that's an intern that's on their phone while they're watching and having like the head programmer watch it
Or even the head programmer saying, hey, intern, pay attention to this one. Let me know how it is because I owe my friend an email back.
But I also think that we get overly obsessed with film festivals as the gatekeepers for our future. And I think that's really wrongheaded, actually. I think need to find your own voice by making something that you truly love and are so proud of, and then that will lead you in the right direction.
Then it even doesn't
if
matter.
Even if every festival says no.
Yeah.
Which could happen even if you make something that's really groundbreaking, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get into all these festivals, because you might just not be like ringing the right bells at the right time.
Yeah, and we've heard the like Paranormal Activity stories where they just get rejected from every single festival and become the most profitable film ever.
I think I've told this story on the podcast, but I was at a test screening at one of the filmmakers' houses of Paranormal Activity and tore it to shreds.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Matt was like, I don't think you should.
I was right.
I maybe still don't like it, but like,
oh, no.
They were like,
so even us geniuses are wrong sometimes.
I know.
Yeah, can imagine. So Sarah, please keep going.
You were
Midnight Swim.
You're saying so much good stuff.
Daniel Stamm told me not to make another fucking short and make a feature, and I listened finally. So instead of making a short, I wrote a 25-page outline for a feature.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, I never thought I was going to do that. In addition to not wanting to make a micro budget, I never thought I'd be making an improv feature either. I always thought like, no.
I'm a writer.
I'm an artiste. So anyway, Daniel was like, go make a improv micro budget. And
I
followed his advice. No. The Midnight Swim is a very weird movie to put into a genre. It's much more like a psycho spiritual quasi horror film, but there's also a family drama.
Cool.
And is that how you imagined it?
Yeah. It was just right. I think in some ways it was, I didn't go to film school. I don't know that much about films. And so I think that's kind of a great way to be, at least when you're at the beginning, because I wasn't trying to emulate anything.
Right.
I just wanted to make a story that was interesting to me. And it turns out that like doesn't neatly fit into genres. I wasn't trying to make a genre movie, really. I was just trying to make a movie about something that was calling to me.
I love it when people's influences are outside of the medium that they're working in.
Yeah.
Almost always.
Yeah. In this case, it was actually a story that I think was an outgrowth of that short film I had made, The Siren. So something about that was still haunting me. That short film was about these three half-sisters who travel to this suicide compound on a lake because one of them is grievously ill and deciding she doesn't want to keep fighting her cancer anymore. It's this strange, mysterious lake where no one's ever found the bottom. It's like this really deep lake. And so I'm not going to give away the short. I don't want to spoil the short. But that concept was really interesting to me. So the feature was sort of an outgrowth of that.
Gotcha. Oh, cool. That makes sense.
In different ways. In the feature, it's a story about three half-sisters, but their mother has gone missing.
So one and a half-sisters.
Yes.
Sorry, no.
Yeah. Their mother has gone mysteriously missing at the bottom of this bottomless lake. So it's a story about sort of making peace with their mother.
Did you shoot it at the same lake?
No, two different lakes, actually.
And what... So you make this movie. Can I ask how much you... shot Midnight Swim for?
$50,000 got us through production.
And shot on video?
Yes, we shot on the Blackmagic.
Oh, cool.
Which was awesome at the time.
That brick.
The big brick
camera.
Yeah. I like the Blackmagic a lot.
Yeah, me too.
It's a good camera.
I think all cameras are awesome at this point.
It's all about lighting also and what you put in front of it.
Yeah, it's like you can get an SMS and it'll look awesome.
Totally.
Yeah. Performances, who cares, right? Put a good
don't
lens.
Need them. Puppets. Music.
So that was like you wrote like a scriptment?
Yeah, it was like a scriptment and very, very collaborative piece with the actors. We all like lived in the same house we were shooting. Mm-hmm. And it was like just a really delightful like summer camp kind of experience where we would like wake up in pajamas and like eat cereal on the living room floor and like talk about what we were going to do that day. And we would discuss the shape of the scene we were about to shoot and like maybe beat it out together. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, sort of beat it out on paper, but then.
Can you give us an example of like what you would write in your treatment to describe a scene? Would it just be like a couple sentences?
Yeah, it depends. Like Buster's Malheur was also a scriptment, like 60 pages or something. And sometimes the scenes would be almost fully fleshed out, actually. And then some scenes would just be, yeah, a couple sentences, something like I knew happens here roughly. And I, versus sometimes I would even in Buster, I would want to write the dialogue out. Mm-hmm. And some scenes would have maybe one line of dialogue. Buster was weird. It's a weirdo script mint, and there's like pictures and stuff too.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Can I ask, why not write the whole thing? What was the thinking specifically for Midnight Swim?
Well, I had been working and working on these other scripts for so long that I think in some ways I was well, I did it by necessity. For the Midnight Swim, it was necessity because we had to go shoot at this location that we had. And like, you know, we
had. Oh, right. Because you literally, like, you put a deposit down. So
it was like, basically, we've already money's been spent. Like, what can we, we need to raise just a little bit more and then just go shoot something. And so that was really by necessity. But what I learned from that was actually, I think I really learned how to be a director on the Midnight Swim and working that way. Mm-hmm. Because it became so much more about
the collaboration.
Listening and the collaboration and like filmmaking, really.
That's when the artiste turned into an artist.
That's damn right. Yeah, because I think when you're writing the script, I think you can be a real perfectionist, actually. And you have to remember that the final product is not the script, it's the movie.
So I guess the reason, right, that we think people write scripts, especially like for their first feature or whatever, is to try to attach people, right? The crew or an actor or something, even if they're not famous, you want to give them something to read. And
well, the weird secret of this town I found out is nobody reads anything anyway, for the most part.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's
nobody
point.
Reads.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, people hate reading.
And what I think actually actors prefer to read, and I've had good success with these scriptments because they're shorter. They read more like a short story. It's actually... It's much more, you can get into the character's head a bit more because it's in prose form.
Do you use
and actors
lines?
Love it. No, not really.
I did a numbered list.
I just like write it like a short story in like broken into scenes.
You were blowing my mind.
I'm working on an outline right now and I do have slug lines. And I'm like, is it weird? Do the slug lines make it harder to read or is it, but my goal is to change this outline into a script, but then. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The script mint thing, I'm really sold on it. Some of my favorite movies are like written like that. Huh. You know, like The One I Love and a bunch of those movies.
I love The One I Love.
Yeah.
Great.
I think
great
I've
film.
Got too much. I'm too.
You're on both sides.
Controlling. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. So.
I do it both ways. I mean, my movie I'm about to make next is fully scripted, but I hope to like bring the lessons of the working non-scripted with me because I think the thing that's great about working from something that's not fully fleshed out is you are actively in the moment forced to discover what's important. You have no script to fall back on.
Yeah,
and that's really exciting and more
incredible.
Dangerous and keeps you on your toes. And so like I need to figure out how to do that with a script that's fully written, in which TV has been a great chance to exercise that.
My fear with the script mint is that the actors will just talk forever. They'll improvise line after line and just talk circles
around.
Don't
give them so much freedom. First of all, actors don't like that much freedom. It makes them very uncomfortable.
How would you keep them from having that much freedom? What would you do? What would you say?
Well, when we were talking about the scene beforehand, we'll beat it out and then and sometimes I'll say, well, maybe you'll say something like this. And maybe you'll say something like this. And then they'll go like, well, I might not say that, but what about this? And so like we're actually writing it. Kind of in the moment together.
Not on camera. You're right.
Not on camera, but we're at least vaguely sort of taking a first draft out loud together. And then the first take, I let that be as messy as it wants to be and as awkwardly long as it wants to be. And then it's a process of editing in each take. And then it comes down to me oftentimes being like, just say this. So then I'm just like, it's almost like I'm improvising as a writer.
Right.
Helping edit and write it as we go.
Right.
As well as they are too. So it's like but it's less like, okay, on this one, I'm going to throw out a word.
sure.
And you do it in a cowboy accent.
Let me recommend you should take some UCB classes because that's not how we do it.
That's not how you do it? No. Oh, it's been a while since I've been to an improv show. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's not Whose Line.
It's not. I mean, no, I'm sure it's more sophisticated than that.
Yeah, but still, there is an element of like saying something stupid, the half-baked to them, and then they'll make it better. There's not a cowboy hat prop, but
right. But you guys are saying the same thing, and Sarah's just saying give them some guide, bumpers.
Yours is more discovery based, and mine is more results based. And okay. I'm really fascinated by this, and it sounds incredible.
It's really great with drama.
Let me ask, how much of the first take did you find you were using in the final edit?
I almost always end up using the first and last takes. Because the first take is the one you didn't fuck up because you didn't like over-direct it. And it's just like whatever was raw and there and really interesting. And then the last take is where you've discovered and grown into something and really like broken through something together. So 9 times out of 10, if I'm just like thinking about what my normal speed is on features, you're lucky if you get 4 takes just because it's like running, not running gun, but like you're on a crazy tight schedule and tight budget. So, but it tends to be like takes 1 and 4. And then every once in a while, like 3 will surprise you or you'll like rewatch 2 and you're like, how did I not see that before? But
it's funny because I feel like maybe it's inversed for me in the way that like your last take is the closest to the quote unquote scripted version in a certain sense, right? Mm. And your first take is the wildest one. Mm-hmm. Normally mine is the other way around where you start on book
and then you're like,
That didn't work.
We got that. Let's try this.
Exactly.
Oh,
interesting. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it, now when I do scripted TV, it's more like that.
Yeah,
actually.
That makes sense. Yeah. You're like,
I try it like this, or maybe say this instead. Yeah. But usually the last take tends to be the best because that's usually when you're like, I got it, let's move on. So we like, hopefully it's the best.
Sure, fair enough.
Right. I get annoyed with editors sometimes because they just like start on the last take because they just
lazy.
Assume that on everything.
I think
and you're
editors
like,
are, I, yeah, as
who
an
needs
editor,
them, right?
As an editor, I can say that we're lazy.
Or under pressure, maybe.
Yeah, or have to do a lot of work fast. But my last question about these kind of
boring to watch
improvised,
like 8 takes.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Do you start with like the master shot so that you kind of figure out like get the blocking
shooting.
And everything, figured out in one shot and then you will go in for coverage?
It just totally depends on the scene because there's certain scenes that are like I was saying with Legion, like there's certain scenes that are like we are doing this camera move that is that thing, and there's I guess that is the master shot.
That's the whole thing.
Yeah,
right.
And
no,
then you like figure out
with
oh.
the script oh, with specifically
the,
when you're improvising.
With the scriptment. With the Midnight Swim, it was a POV movie. So what was really amazing and interesting is that caused all kinds of wonderful restrictions.
Yeah, bomb drop. So like it's one character's POV.
Yeah, it's one character's POV.
Like helmet cammy sort of.
Not or? Helmet cammy. She has a camera. But it's like very much like from her emotional point of view. It's like the camera is built into her psyche in the story. So like she is someone with mental illness who like uses this camera to like filter the world. And so what she's looking at tells us so much about what she's feeling in The Midnight Swim. And so it really like was such a beautiful way to sculpt directing choices because it was always about like, well, what's June feeling right now in the scene?
Right.
And so there might be times where like, a normal movie, you would see so much more. But in this scene, she's only looking at one person's face because that person's making her uncomfortable.
Did you ever have her like go into a helicopter and get a cool establishing shot?
No.
Sorry, I just want to get clear.
Yeah. But great follow-up question, Oren.
The camera is not omniscient, but it's not. Is it that she's operating a camera?
She's operating a camera.
So it's as though it's almost like Cloverfield style or found footage style.
I don't use found footage is because it's not a thing where like someone discovered a box of tapes.
Right.
It's actually the whole notion was how do we get in someone's head and see the world through their eyeballs. So I think
but
of it
still filtered through the character is holding
but
a camera.
She's an unreliable narrator and the camera itself becomes unreliable.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which there's elements of that in Legion too. Mm. A lot of elements of
totally.
That.
It's my jam.
Well, I want to know what happened with Midnight Swim. Did it
not enough?
Yeah,
we're going back to my series of disappointments. That's my life story.
Okay,
see, my memoir.
This is all incredible though, because I think there's a lot of people who think like I'm going to make my micro budget and then and it doesn't happen
really
for them, and then they're heartbroken.
But you know what? You can't. What's the Rolling Stones quote? You can't always get what you want, but you try sometimes and you find you get what you need. That's been very true for me. So I wanted The Midnight Swim to do so much better than it did. It did very well. I'm certainly not complaining or ungrateful for mm-hmm. how well it did, but I had even higher hopes and expectations.
When you say well, like it premiered at a good festival?
It premiered at a great festival, but it didn't premiere at Sundance.
Mm-hmm. Which one did it premiere at?
At the Fantasia
Festival,
which is great, and then at AFI.
Great.
Great, amazing festivals. I love them forever.
You found out you got what you needed. What was
which
the thing
was,
you needed?
I got managers, and I got offered to direct a segment of Holidays, mm-hmm. which got me into the DGA, mm-hmm. which was amazing.
And so
it was
Holidays,
like these little mini steps that helped me. It's all been like a lot of tremendously hard work and small steps forward.
And Holidays was a studio film?
Oh, that feels like a stretch, mm-hmm. given that business model. Holidays was, it's an amazing, I was so grateful for that opportunity. It was also just like really smart producing. Because they basically asked eight genre directors at that Fantasia Film Festival is a genre film festival. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a story I think you told before we started recording this podcast of like The Midnight Swim's like not really a genre movie.
Yeah,
it like sort of is, but it like played at this genre festival.
Yeah.
So I was like starting to be seen as a genre director and got asked to do Holidays. And that was the first time in my life anyone had approached me and said, let me give you a little bit of money to make something. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, yes, like very fast. Yes,
deal.
I don't care what you're asking me to do.
And did they find you through your managers? Like, or
this might have been. Oh gosh, I think that might have been before I got my managers.
So just off the festival.
Someone had seen Adam Egypt Mortimer, who was one of the producers, had seen The Midnight Swim at Fantasia.
Oh,
that's
cool.
How it happened. I don't think it was a studio movie, considering each director got $25,000 to make their short. It's no laughing sum, but it certainly like they knew that all the directors they tapped, like Kevin Smith being the biggest name of them, were all
your uncle,
my uncle, Uncle Kev,
Kevin Adina Smith,
Cass. They knew that, or at least for me. Like when you tap a bunch of directors to do an anthology, there's going to be a natural level of like competition. Mm-hmm. So as a producer, that's a really smart business model. Like I'm only going to give you a tiny amount of money and who's going to make mm-hmm. the best thing. And I felt like I had a lot to prove. This is like the first like time anyone's just like handed me money to make something. And then, also I was like the token lady of the project. So I felt like I had just, mm-hmm. I was so afraid they were going to change their minds and take the money back. So I just like ran straight at it and like I finished my short first, which is so sad, but true. Cause I was just like, I'm going to need to spend this before they can change their minds.
And so did you write it too? Or did they give you a script?
I wrote it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you just went for it.
And what was that one about?
That one's called Mother's Day. So it's called Holidays. Every director got to pick a holiday. Mm-hmm. I asked for Thanksgiving and they were like, let's give that to a more important director.
Oh, gotcha.
Right.
What's your second choice? And then I was like, oh, Yom Kippur or Mother's Day.
Yom Kippur. That's awesome.
Yeah. But, I really love the short I ended up making. I think it's like and Holidays is a cool little mishmash of different films. I think in some ways my short lives best on its own. I'm not trying to take anything away from the anthology itself, but like in the context of the anthology, it's a little weird because I'm a weird director. It's much more like sort of tonal mm-hmm. and strange the way I'm strange, and maybe doesn't necessarily fit with all the other films.
Did Holidays get you Buster's Mall heart?
No, it got me in the DGA. It got me
and so
more
did you have to pay
experience.
Like 10 grand or whatever to join the DGA, or did they pay that for you?
They had done, it was really a wonderful way into the DGA because they negotiated a smaller fee.
Oh, that's good
which
on
was
them.
So yeah, great. Yeah. I still had to take a loan out to like pay that fee, but it was much smaller than it could have been. I got that movie because one of the key investors in The Midnight Swim decided to take another shot with me. So really, The Midnight Swim helped me make Buster. Mm-hmm. I made another movie.
So you made another movie.
And can you, I haven't seen it. What's the title all about?
I just think that's really shameful, Oren.
Do you remember what my movie's called? I said it's
Hammer.
10 minutes ago.
Deaf
Ooh.
People.
Ooh.
The Hammer.
Ooh.
Whatever.
I forgot. So at least you got
okay, but that was pretty good. That was pretty good. So what's it about?
I get sad when I have to do the what's it about pitch line for my movie. You should get, just people of the world listening to this podcast, just Google it.
You want me? I'll take a swing.
Really?
Oren loves to do this.
Yeah. And I hate so, this.
Yeah. And guess log
line. You can correct me. Okay. So I'm not going to go log line because I think it would probably be a little too hard, but I'll summarize real quick. So Rami Malek is...
Mr. Robot.
The Mr. Robot.
Slash star of Buster's Small Heart, also yes. known for Mr. Robot.
Freddie Mercury in the new Bryan Singer film.
Papillon?
Forgive me. Right? It's been a minute. Is it?
Probably not.
Is he Buster? He's Buster.
He is.
Yeah. Okay. So Rami Malek, Mr. Robot, aka Buster, he's like a young father, and he works the midnight shift basically at a hotel, and he meets this kind of drifter played by the weird guy
DJ Qualls,
yeah, who's kind of like shady and like curious and has kind of all these crazy conspiracy theories, and he and Rami kind of like go in together on. Like a low rent heist, basically, where they steal the valuables from the people.
You're doing really good. Now stop. Too much information. They don't need. I don't.
And then the ending is insane.
But that was really, really good.
Okay, and then things unravel from there.
There you go. Buster's Not Heart is a story about one man whose soul is split into two, which is. Impossible, right? One person actually becoming two. And so it's about a man who actually tears space-time a new asshole. We briefly thought about renaming the movie Two Assholes because we thought it would do a lot better and we probably should have.
It's a little harder to Google, I think.
But what is Mal? What does Mal mean? Like
it
bad?
It means bad. Yeah, Spanish, sick, sad, bad.
Okay.
And it's cool. Tonally, it's like, it's shot very artistically. It's like there's a lot of headroom and like it's like very moody and contrasty.
Mr. Robot stole that from you.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Sorry.
I know. It's a sensitive thing for me because I hadn't even seen Mr. Robot when I made Buster's Small Heart. And then
hadn't been shot yet, had it?
No, so when we cast, the day we sent Rami our offer, his face started showing up on billboards and posters. And I was like, God damn it. Really? Like this guy's like, now all of a sudden he's really famous.
But that's awesome, right?
Yeah, that's good for you, you know.
No, but that's bad because I was like, he'll never read the script now.
He just sent the offer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I thought we had this brilliant casting idea. Mm-hmm.
And you had seen him in,
Short Term 12 was what had caught my attention, but,
He was in the Twilight films as well.
Night at the Museum, The Pacific.
Tangent.
He loves when people talk about Night in the Museum.
That is really funny. You guys know his credits better than I do. You have a special thanks on Short Term 12. How come?
I went to a feedback screening.
I fucking love that movie.
Lots of notes.
It's so good.
It's an amazing movie. Such talented group.
Very jealous. That's excellent. So Mr. Robot is blowing up.
Yes, so Mr. Robot's blowing up.
And what in your offer do you send the scriptment? What do you send?
Yeah, the scriptment. Probably sent a letter. Those no one ever reads either, but I keep reading them.
Are you? How confident are you in that fact?
I feel
the agent reads it, right? For sure.
I don't think so.
I will say that
I really don't. I'm very at this moment in my life
because we've had a lot of guests on here feel like they. Got someone by writing a letter.
Liz Manischel will disagree with you till the day she dies. She got Bobby Moynihan.
Well, maybe Liz writes absolutely stunning.
No, but Jessica Sanders also told us she writes letters.
And
a lot of people. That's how she got Simon Helper.
I write letters. I have a hard time believing that anyone
reads them.
Yeah. Do you include that information in the letter? You're like, you're
I
probably
should start
not
writing
write.
Like sarcastic letters.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're reading this now.
Yeah. I will say this. I've offered some fancy people, and when they've called me to very politely turn me down, which is, I think, a very class act, they'll say, oh, I read your letter, and it was really nice, and I wanted to reach out.
People call you?
Yeah.
To turn you down?
Who's the most famous person that's called you?
Yeah. That's what a beautiful thing. That has never happened to me.
Isn't that classy?
I get silence.
I shouldn't.
I get a single line from an agent, so-and-so respectfully passes. And I don't.
I didn't even get the respectful.
He was like, I don't want to do this through agents and stuff. I just wanted to call you.
That's awesome. That's a unique thing though.
Yeah. Pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Buster's plays Toronto. Did it have a theatrical release or no? It did.
It did.
Yeah, yeah. It played down the street from
it
me.
It did, yeah. We had a pretty good, I think we played in like 50 cities.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's great.
We did pretty well with a company called Wellgo. That was the distributor's
Wellgo?
Name. Wellgo? Wellgo, USA.
Wellgo.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
They're
love
like,
them.
Their bread and butter is bringing rad Asian movies to the American market. And they had just, with Buster was the first one where they wanted to tap into American indies.
Interesting.
So we went with them.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm.
And so then you started moving into TV. How did you transition from indie features into HBO TV shows?
The home box office. We were just about to premiere at Toronto, and then two actors who were in The Midnight Swim, who are dear friends of ours now, who I didn't know. I just cast them in The Midnight Swim.
You went
Swim.
To summer camp with them and
yes,
made a movie.
And we became BFFs. They recommended me to Mark and Jay Duplass, who are their friends, and I went in and had a pitch interview. Mm-hmm. On this show and just hit it off with Mark about a script he'd written. And I think that he and I like share a sort of twisted, dark sense of humor, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And so he ended up asking me to do a second episode as well. So I got to do two episodes. They're both totally messed up and I love them.
When you met with him, had you read the scripts already?
I had read I was just meeting on one script. I think I was just meeting on Ralphie to begin with. And totally loved it. And then the Knock and Do came about later.
Did you walk in with like confidence, even though you'd never done TV before? Were you like scared?
I always walk in with confidence because I'm always like really ready to die at any time. So I feel like I'm just like living a genuinely nothing to lose.
Metal, and that's the pull quote. Yeah.
Wait, so... But do you come in with like all these really strong ideas of how it should look? Or are you a little more introspective and like, I was thinking it might be fun if we do this? Like, how do you pitch on it?
I really just take each project separately. So I read Ralphie. I, you know, jot down any sort of first ideas that come to me on a first reading. And then I oftentimes just like let myself do a judgment-free internet dive and like find images that like speak to me. And then I kind of put together, I can't remember if in Ralphie I've actually like put together a sort of lookbook sort of ahead of time. I may have just gone in and just talked about things that I saw and loved about it and then followed up maybe with the PDF perhaps.
And then just to like explore your process a little bit more. So you read the script, it's an anthology show, right? Room 104?
It is. But what's so much fun as like, I am the most spoiled person on earth that was my first TV gig because Room 104, each episode is totally different. The only rule is that it has to take place in this one room, Room 104. So it's like making a short film.
Right.
So it really wasn't like directing traditional TV
right. At
all. I just got to go make two short films, which was... Right. A total scam.
How long are
and
they?
I loved it. 22 to 28 kind of minutes.
Are they hard scripted the way your future work is, or was it
they
more?
Were hard, no, they were hard scripted. But I also was given, I mean, like within reason, sort of like that line doesn't work so much. Sure. Or actually, we only had 3 days to shoot each of those episodes, which was not a lot, and it was really hard. And so I had to make. I think I really tapped into my like on the fly scriptment improv skills in that like I'd have to be like, what's crucial here? What can we lose? Mm-hmm. We have an hour left and we're supposed to do three scenes. That's not going to work. Like, you know, like I could do a lot of that reshaping and like sort of writing on the fly as a director.
Mm-hmm. And then
we're open to it.
I think that it was... I hope they were open to it because that's what I did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, obviously.
Within,
you got a second episode.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But going back to like your image.
I wasn't changing anything that was, I think I did a pretty good job of where I had to make changes on the fly. It was like always very much within the spirit of the thing. It wasn't,
I'm just curious about like when you're doing this unjudgmental dive into the internet, finding images. So you read the script and you just...
I try to work in two different brains.
Yeah.
And they're so equally important. And one is the like safe space, there are no stupid questions, no stupid thoughts. Like, just literally, like, give yourself permission. The way I would give my actors permission on the day to do their best work, I try to give myself that permission, whether it's in writing or directing. It's actually harder to do in writing, I think. So you have the one brain, which is just the, like, play brain. And then you have your editing brain. And then you, that's when you need to put your, like, analytical story structure hat on, and, like, then you're going back and being judgmental and making choices and editing it down. But I think it's really important that you keep them as separate as possible.
Yeah. But so when you read that script, what do you type into Google? Like Mark Duplass?
TV. I type in TV.
Mark Duplass TV
Television. Oh.
Do you remember the first thing? What was the seed?
Ralphie?
Yeah. You were like, oh, I read this.
My brother. So when I read Ralphie, I think what I responded to is the first idea that came to me is he needs to wear a cape. You guys probably haven't seen it yet, so this makes no sense to you. But Ralphie was like this really like wonderful young boy character. And I have two older sisters and a younger brother, and my younger brother was just a terror growing up, and he used to wear this like Superman cape and refused to take it off. So I think that may have been the first seed for me, jumping off point.
Cool. And then where do you find your images? Just like everywhere? Pinterest?
Everywhere. There used to be the most amazing site in the world, and it got taken down, and it breaks my heart still. I've never found anything quite as good. There used to be a site called Found.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And then like it turned to porn. It like very slowly turned into a porn site and then died.
Like a photographer, like
yeah, like
nudes
artful nudes.
Right.
That just got like as each year went on, got like more and more graphic until it became just not useful.
Gross porn.
By the way, our friend Blake wants to start a ramen place called Tasteful Nudes.
Oh, it's about noodle place. Really good idea.
Nudes 2 O's. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm in for that.
What was Found?
Like, it's like a image aggregator site, I guess, that was just like, but it was
like a Tumblr.
I was never
page
cool enough to be invited to add to it. Like it was more exclusive. The people, I think you had to be invited to contribute. Mm-hmm. But so it was very well curated until it got porny.
Gotcha.
I don't know what happened. But if you guys have, I would love recommendations. I'm always looking for good. I've never quite found a site as good.
Yeah, there's, yeah. I mean, we talk about sites we love all the time. Mm-hmm. I actually just sent some creative director emailed me and he's like, hey, I listen to your podcast and I'm making a treatment. Can you send me some of your favorite sites? And I just sent him a list of like 20 sites I can forward it to.
Oh my God. I mean, they
literally have like Google and Pinterest on there, but also Film Grab.
You put Google on the list?
Well, I walked him through my method. Okay, like I start on Google Images, you know, and then this tool that I...
Yes. Actually, Google Images is a great way to start because if you find one thing you like, then you visit that page and then you can take a dive.
Yeah. Well, there's this other amazing thing on web browsing where you can like right click on an image and say, search for this image on Google, on other sites.
Yeah.
And it'll find you. You can usually get to like the original posting of that image, like the high res posting. And then any place that posts like really high res images usually has other great high res images. And yeah, so a lot of like kind of web walking.
Resolution is a big thing for you, though.
Right? Yeah, I don't like things unresolved.
Yeah.
Yeah. For your decks.
Hey, let's keep it
clean.
Yeah, Found 1.0.
People really listen to this? I feel like it got really boring.
I guarantee they do.
Okay, so where were we? Oh, yeah, sorry. So you made a treat. You met with Mark Duplass.
Mm-hmm.
You had a good chemistry with him.
Mm-hmm.
You sent him images, you got the job, you shot it, they loved it, you did the second one, and then just everything was, then you just got a million calls for TV offers after that? Do you get an agent at this point?
Oh, I got an agent, I got the job, Room 104, and then I got an agent like a week later. And that was all leading up to Toronto.
Perfect timing.
Yeah.
That means you don't have to give somebody a couple $1,000.
But it also is hilarious because it's like, I have for many years tried to get an agent and it never worked. And it's like the moment you kind of don't need an agent, like I got like made a couple movies and got my own TV gigs. Like that's when I got an agent.
Because agents want to
make money.
Latch onto
you.
Someone that's making money, not someone that's not making money.
Yeah.
It's the most frustrating advice because but you hear it all the time. You won't get an agent until
you don't need
they find you.
Yeah, I think it's really true. Yeah. I think you shouldn't waste your time trying. Yeah.
So literally you had an HBO show and two features under your belt. And then someone was like, oh, hey.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah, so wait, don't sweat it, everybody.
But I think I missed... So you got into Toronto, mm-hmm. and you shot the two episodes of Room 104 before you even screened?
I think I got into Toronto, we screened there, and then shot the two episodes in like October or November.
So you were on a hot streak. Life right. was good.
It was
were
you,
pretty
this
good.
This is when it you might, jumped it, your that, boyfriend and got a new like
no,
male model.
No.
Sarah oh,
I've been convertible. I'm like super extra happily married and to my DP who has been, you know, through all the ups and downs on everything on this entire.
Saves you a lot of money. Yeah.
That's why I did yeah. it.
Also,
I don't,
you can't
I don't,
get
can't
divorced.
Pay him exactly. And he can,
do
I
you
can
ever,
be
like,
in prep with him whenever I want.
Do you ever want to hire a different DP? And
oh yeah, that's an can't? Interesting question. Yeah.
We're both
oh.
married to actresses. So we, oh. We're in this boat. A
no,
lot.
Actually I have the reverse problem where, like I wanted to hire him on Hannah, for example, but he doesn't have enough TV experience on his resume, mm-hmm. so it's hard to get him hired. Mm-hmm. So I ended up being able to bring him on to do second unit, which is great to get some TV on his resume. This is like the montage part of my life story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like things are going great. Yeah. I'm stretching my hamstrings and stuff. And the HBO show was like the first time I'd ever gotten an actual real paycheck.
Yeah. Ever. And when you say an actual real paycheck, you mean a paycheck period.
A paycheck period for making...
For directing.
For directing.
Like you had gotten money
before. Paid as an editor or like a writing job here and there, but like...
But you got, you so...
A DGA directing paycheck, which after everyone took their cut was not as big as I thought it was going to be.
You made
and as much work as I put into it, I was like, oh, that's still actually
Three movies and then you cashed the check.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
And the TV episodes too.
Yeah.
And Sirens. On iTunes.
Sarah, available on iTunes.
Sure, $1.99. Help her out.
And
but,
so now,
but that is so essential for people to hear and to understand and to not be bummed on, like, you know, start your graphic design company, PA, hustle. It's all, that's
totally.
All part of it. You
I think
know?
It is. There are lots of different routes to take as well. Like there are people who take the like, get a traditional job mm-hmm. in the film industry route and then like work on your thing on the side. And I think I don't know, whatever this, the graphic design thing worked for me because I was still being creative and like ended up working on a lot of skills I still use today. Like mm-hmm. I still use my graphic design like
of course, yeah.
all the damn time. But maybe it was like I was, because I wasn't like saturated in a job that was already in the industry directly all the time, I still had energy mm-hmm. for my own stuff yeah. on weekends and nights.
Do you think your graphic design skills make you... It help you be a better at pitching because you can show yeah. people stuff the way you imagine
and
it.
And because I spent so much of my time in that job pitching to clients.
Uh-huh.
Ew, so I actually got, I think, pretty good at reading a room and pitching and yeah. understanding how to sell something.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know, I'm really into fonts and stuff. And I feel like people yeah. think it's silly, but I think it's
no,
like
it's
one
really
of the
important.
Yeah, important things is if you're a visual
the
artist, it doesn't matter.
The font that we are using for the... Hannah TV show was the same font I chose for the my pitch document when I yeah. got
Futura?
The job. Yeah, Helvetica.
I'm an Arial fan myself.
What
no,
font
it was a
is
custom.
It?
I made it.
From Defunct?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I made it.
You make your own font?
Well, it was like just for the word mark, Hannah.
Yeah. Wow, you really
still that's
really go deep.
Pretty good.
They're like, we had two directors. We had this Scorsese fellow, but someone, this lady made her own
made
font.
Made a font. I mean, it was, font is, that's a stretch. I'm,
sure, sure. What program do you use to make a font? Like, where do you make
this
a font?
I was just an Illustrator. It's very simple. You'll gotcha. See it when you see the design. It's not like, it's not serif. It's not like ornate in any way. Yeah.
Yeah. I like a little sans slab.
My brother-in-law, who Alex Seth, who's like an amazing graphic designer and worked for us when we had our graphic design shop he worked for us for like 8 years. He's a proper type designer. Mm-hmm. Like he is like, you know, woodcut, like, yeah. yeah. He I should never claim to have made a font because he would yell at me.
Yeah,
yeah.
He's like, that font made you.
Exactly.
So now are you in a place in your career where you get to turn down jobs that you're getting offered yeah. multiple jobs and you get to turn down the ones that
yeah,
are less interesting.
It's super weird. It's weird new territory for mm-hmm. me for sure. And I also, I have this like nagging fear that like I just keep saying no to things, and that seems like a bad idea. Like, what if no one ever asks me to do things again? You know, like, I definitely have that strange anxiety now where I feel like, is this the only window of opportunity? Should I just be saying yes more readily to things? But I have, this is goddamn cheesy, but true. Like, I have inside of me stories I feel I need to tell. I worked this hard to get this point to be able to try and tell them. So I'm still trying to do that as not just a director, but as a writer director. And so I'm trying to give myself the space to keep developing those things. And if like the right amazing project comes along, I'll say yes. But I'm trying not to just take projects to take projects.
And how do you know when to say no?
9 times out of 10, it just sucks. Anyway, so it's really easy. The material's really bad. But then there's sometimes where it's really hard because the materials, the hardest one is the material's okay or even decent. But there's somebody attached that you'd love to work with. So it's like, oh, maybe I can make it better. You know, like maybe, oh, I could see my way into this, you know? Yes. And so it's really like tempting.
My life story. Yeah,
it's really tempting. And you feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't say no to that. That's, you know, like, but deep down you've got this inner voice telling you like, that's, you don't need to make that movie. Like that movie doesn't really need to be made. I think that's part of the way I've been measuring it for myself, at least, is like, we live in a time when there's just a glut of things to watch. There's so many movies and so many TV shows, so much great stuff. But I think that makes me in some ways even pickier because it's like we all have limited time here on this earth, like limited years that we can spend our energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just really have to have a real deep reason to want to make the thing, I think, at this point. It's too much work otherwise.
And that counts for a TV episode as well.
It's a little bit different with TV. I mean, because with TV, it's like a little bit more, I kind of have done 2 years of TV in a row, and I did it knowing that I needed to get myself to a place to be able to take a pause.
Mm-hmm.
Again, back to like first paychecks, maybe paying down some debt. Getting a dentist, for example.
Yeah, adulting. Like,
yeah.
Doing some things, which was like amazing. But beyond that, also, it's like you're a guest artist on someone else's show. So it's you can have a little emotional distance from the thing that you're doing.
It can be a job.
It's a great job.
Yeah.
An absolutely amazing job. Hannah's a little different. Hannah really felt like my adopted baby. You know, like I really, because I did the pilot and was a co-EP on it and felt like it was like I was really giving myself to it the way I would a film.
You get paid on every episode of that show?
That is the secret dirty trick of being a pilot director.
Yeah, the pilot, that's the
God
one to get.
God bless the Directors Guild of America.
Yeah. Well, you're doing all that work.
And
you're
God bless unions.
The tone. Yeah.
I'm a communist. I hope you guys don't mind. I'm like a straight up communist agitator and I think everyone should unionize right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
George Soros says
that's
made you to
he's
say
paying
that.
Me.
Matt, any final questions?
Let's hop into unpaid endorsements.
Unpaid endorsements.
Oren, you got something?
Yeah, I got a couple things. Well, one, I just feel like we don't talk about this enough, but we have two editors. Christopher Robert Gray is a very handsome, very good actor. Look him up. He's in SAG.
Cast him in your thing.
He'll change his name if you want to do non-union. Come on. No, but Matt's seen him work before. I have not had a role for him yet, but I'm very excited to use him. But check him out, Christopher Robert Gray. Our other editor, Jay McAuliffe, she has an awesome podcast. It's called We Must Ignite. It's about a lot of things, about life, but it's kind of like questions of gender in...
And the creative spaces.
In the creative spaces.
The greater Phoenix area.
But... Look up We Must Ignite, the podcast. It's really awesome. It's like much better produced than this podcast.
Yeah.
It's like more like an NPR podcast, you know, with segments and music and thoughtful writing. But my other endorsement, I don't know why, but I've been super obsessed with this Israeli mentalist named Lior Suchard. Lior is his first name, Lior Suchard, Suchard. Have you guys heard of this guy?
No.
He's been around for a while.
Is Suchard Hebrew for Swiss shard?
Yes. He basically shows you different recipes you can make with Swiss chard. No, he is he's a mentalist and he does two things. He can read your mind and he can influence you to think about something. And it's like...
It's for realsies?
It's totally for real. Like, he just... I watched... You can just look him up on YouTube. I watch him on Good Morning America, Good Morning Britain, on Live with Regis and Kelly, or whoever, someone in Kelly, The View, every single show. He was on James Corden. That's like my favorite one. He had like Harry Connick Jr. was on there, and he just looked at Harry Connick Jr. He was like, think of your PIN number, you know, for your ATM card. And he wrote the PIN number. And he's like, this
I'm going to look that up.
It's so insane. And then he does this other trick. I feel like I shouldn't even give it away, but I'm going to give it away just to sell you guys on it. At James Corden, he does this thing where he's talking to the audience and he gives them all like this white piece of foam core and everyone draws a circle on it. And he says, I want you really fast to just like the first thing that comes to your mind, like draw a picture of it. He's like, you could draw like a Superman symbol. You could draw like a cross. You could draw a mountain. You could draw like a rabbit, whatever. And he shows like, it's like, draw whatever you want. And he's like, and James, you go draw like something and whatever. To make a long story short, every single person drew a star. Every single person in the audience, including James Corden. And then he had Alice Eve, you know, the actress. He had her draw something and he guessed what she was going to draw by drawing it. And it was like the same thing, which was like a hand with two candles next to it. Like, it was so random. Anyway, this guy is just like so insanely talented. And I just see him on show after show after show. Like, there's no camera tricks. There's no anything. He just, like, if you rolled a die under the table, like a six-sided die, and looked at it, he could tell you what number you see. Anyhow, check him out, Lior Suchard.
Sarah, what you got?
Mine's going to be like a lot less exciting
That. That's the most excited Dora's ever been.
Yeah, last week
I started watching these YouTube videos by number file, which are really fun. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the way in which I wish math had been taught to me. It's just a really fun, different videos about like strangeness in numbers.
Yeah. PH.
Yeah. Number file. Those who like numbers. Someone who likes numbers. And it's like different like set theory and sequence theory and shapes that are weird. But every time my mind is blown and then I want to go back to school.
Oh, cool. Number file. Sounds great.
Cool. Yeah, that's a... That endorsement
like
was a little too long.
That was also... I know. And I just feel like you had so much passion and enthusiasm. And then I was like, number five.
No, we're going to edit mine down to be like Jay's podcast.
Okay. All right.
If Jay's editing it. Or Christopher Robert Gray is handsome.
So...
Chris is editing.
So I've got two. One is our friend of the show, Jordan Brady, had... the Moon Unit.
Oh, yeah.
A correspondent from the Moon Unit, which is a company that helps you write treatments. And it's really good. They do really awesome work, and like they do design and layout and all that sort of stuff. But the other thing that's interesting about them is that if you go onto their website, just Google the Moon Unit, they'll send you a few like emails that kind of have like decks attached to them that'll break down things like how to give yourself your career more heat or what creative directors are looking for. And so I signed up for their email newsletter. I get it every once in a while, and it's just like a little insightful tip about booking more commercial work. So I totally think it's worth doing. And also kind of reminds me of like the things I want to be doing in the commercial space. Yeah. So just check out the Moon Unit.
And by the way, something that I wish I knew years ago, like I always thought hiring someone to help you with your treatment would be like
I don't understand
thousands
that.
And thousands of dollars.
But also, I didn't know you could do that.
You know, it seems weird.
That seems weird. That seems like
I'll show you
someone
some
to
stuff
paint
right
painting.
After the podcast.
Really?
But it's kind of awesome. But I used to think it's like...
I thought that was like the job.
Absurdly expensive. But you can basically pay someone like $500 a day to either do the layout for you or to write your treatment for you or to find images for you or do all three. Depends how involved the treatment is.
Do you first give that person a brief or you literally are like, you do it? Like, how does it work?
Well, so you have a call with the agency.
Yeah.
You, the director, get the boards from the agency, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have a call with the agency and that call is recorded and they listen to that call, first of all. When I do it, I do all of my own writing and I do like most of my own image pulling, but I've learned to accept the help on the design and the layout and stuff. And so,
and the font choice, things like that. It's basically designers who have a lot of experience in the world of pitching commercials.
Okay. Yeah. Some directors might say it's a comedy spot. Just make it look funny. Other people, like I always say, like I really like widescreen treatments, you know? And so kind of go extra wide. Mm. This is like a fantasy mystery thing. Let's go dark backgrounds. I really like kind of these colors and this font. And let's do, I like full bleed, you know, where the images go to the edge of the page. But some, I'm sure, like I was talking to the Famous Group today, the production company, they said some directors don't like writing them. So we'll bring a copywriter in here to sit with the director and they just like bat around ideas.
Yeah, yeah. I've got an old friend actually who writes briefs all the time and treatments and like has worked with the same directors for their entire careers.
This has blown my mind.
Right?
Yeah. So for like $1,000, I mean, $1,000 is a lot of money to spend, but if it is going to get you the job that's making you $20,000 or whatever, and even if you only get one out of three of them, then it might not be a bad idea. And if it's like a feature and you're trying to get $1 million and you're just...
They feel do like it for features too?
They'll do it for anything.
This
you can
is
pitch
crazy.
A TV show.
It actually feels like slightly...
Like cheating, I know.
Cheating and weird and dirty.
Yeah.
It's not. I've come to feel like it's not. I felt exactly the same way when I found out about this.
I'm just processing right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but take a look. The Moon Unit. They do great work. And like I said, those emails actually, like it's a nice email to receive.
Didn't you have a second one or is that...
So I keep a list of just kind of random ideas for this because I'm not getting a ton of cultural input lately. But one recommendation that I have, Orin made me say it. So I just started a new job at a new building. And, you know, I always say the first day you're trying to like figure out where the printer is and like who does what and like where's my office and that sort of stuff. And a thing that I wish that people would tell you and I wish I had the courage to ask, is where the poop bathroom is.
Is there a separate bathroom for
pooping? Oftentimes, there is a...
This is a theory Matt has devised. It's not a truism, what he's about to say. Just telling you that.
Is it bad that I just, like, poop in any bathroom?
No. So
I'd poop in your bathroom right now, Orin, if I had to.
What I'm saying is...
Thank you.
I'd poop with your daughter sleeping in the next room. Your baby daughter.
Yeah, you don't want to see where she's pooped in this
In,
house.
Like, an office environment, you know, there's a situation where there's the high traffic, high volume bathroom that's kind of in the middle of the office. And then, like, you know, if somebody poops in that bathroom... It stinks up the whole place. And like they're like, oh boy, Jerry always takes a dump after coffee or whatever, right? And so in a big office building, there'll be one that's less trafficked where you can like take your time and, you know, maybe there's always toilet paper or whatever. Everyone who works in the office knows which is the poop bathroom.
And is it weird that everyone knows when you walk to that bathroom, everyone's like, they're going to go take a shit.
Yeah.
Like, do you feel like everyone knows you're shitting?
I've worked in many corporate places. I've never heard of this concept before. So
then you are missing out, my friend. I will say this. There's an episode of Detroiters, one of my favorite shows, where they take a little basket. It's a plot point in the show. They take the basket. They say, see you later. They hop in the elevator. They go up to empty floor above them that hasn't been taken out, and then they go poop up there, and then they come back down. And then
what's in the basket?
Oh, just like, you know, like
magazines,
magazines, and like you know, hand sanitizer or whatever.
tomorrow when you go to the office,
and it is a travesty when a startup moves into that floor, and they're like, "What are we going to do now?" That is the plot of an episode of a television show, so it's not that crazy. I told it to my friend who works in a hospital. She said the lobby is always the poop bathroom. Because that's not as high traffic.
Well, that's where you can blame the patients. You know?
I'm learning a lot tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
When you go to the office, I think if you wink when you ask where the bathroom is, they'll tell you the poop bathroom.
Yeah, well.
If you guys have any feedback, want to drop us a line or justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram @justshootitpod. Are you on any of these?
Yeah, where can people follow you best?
Maybe Instagram. Yeah. Occasional. Okay. It's just my name. There's nothing creative
at Sarah
about
Dina
it.
Smith.
All three names.
Cool. Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm @SmiteyPyleg.
And I'm @MrMattEnlow. You can follow us on all social media @JustShootItPod. Visit us at JustShootItPod.com for all of the stuff that we talked about, show notes, unpaid endorsements, etc.
Scriptments.
This episode was edited by Christopher Robert Gray. Our producer is Madeline Rosewatt. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. The music you're listening to right now was by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.